digital station for comedy, drama, and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And now Christian Rodsker reads the fifth and final part of John Carey's biography of William Golding, the man who wrote Lord of the Flies.
At 10 o'clock in the morning on Thursday, the 6th of October, 1983, Golding was phoned from Stockholm by an unknown journalist, referred to in his journal as Ingmar Watsit, who told him that he had a 50-50 chance of winning the Nobel Prize for Literature and might get a call about it in a couple of hours. Golding was far from pleased. It seemed to him that it was mere thoughtless selfishness, typical of journalists, to inflict 2 hours of anxiety on him and then probable disappointment. "I am shaking with quite unnecessary excitement," he noted, adding, "No, I'm not. I'm dismissing the idea and being calm." At 1 o'clock, the news was on radio and television. He had won the Nobel Prize. After that, the phone rang more or less continuously. Golding hated publicity, and his reaction was typical. 2 years before, at the age of 70, he had learned to ride and had bought a horse called Cobber. With the prospect of his home being invaded by television people, journalists and photographers, he mounted Cobber and rode off into the Wiltshire countryside, leaving Anne to face the music. He gathered from the news that one of the judges on the Nobel jury had, as he put it, disagreed violently and said I was a small British phenomenon of no importance. This was the Swedish poet Arthur Lundqvist, known as the grand old man of Swedish letters. He had not said exactly what Golding attributed to him, but he had questioned whether Golding had sufficient international weight for a Nobel laureate. Next day, the English newspapers were full of it. Lundqvist was an inveterate intellectual, and his opposition to Golding was essentially just the common highbrow disdain for writers who appeal to a wide readership. All the same, Golding was hurt by it, and by the controversy surrounding his award. Nobel judges were supposed to remain silent for 55 years, but once Lundqvist had gone public, his colleagues became copiously communicative. One of them told the Daily Telegraph that 2 voting sessions had been needed before the award was made to Golding. But another, Knut Arnlund, reassured Golding in a confidential letter that the choice of a Nobel laureate was almost never unanimous. The winner often only had a small majority, and Golding's had been well above normal. It was simply bad luck, Arnlund concluded, that one of our members should have lost his wits at the wrong moment. According to a gossip item in The Observer, Mrs. Thatcher's office had phoned the Arts Council when news of the Nobel Award came through, saying that the Prime Minister would like to write and congratulate the author, but a few things had to be cleared up first. "He's all right, isn't he?" was the question. "I mean, he's not divorced or anything like that. You're sure there's nothing, well, you know, odd about him?" The Cecil Parkinson love child scandal had just broken, so a degree of prime ministerial caution was understandable. Once Golding's normality had been vouched for, a communication duly arrived from Mrs. Thatcher. "I am delighted by the recognition given to you and English literature by the award of the Nobel Prize. My warmest congratulations." This was followed by an invitation to meet President Mitterrand at 10 Downing Street. He and Anne accepted, but he did not enjoy the occasion much, partly because he was too nervous to understand the torrent of French with which Mitterrand greeted him, and partly because he was seated next to a titled lady whose stupidity exasperated him. "How does one answer such silly people?" he wondered. The aftermath of the Nobel rumbled on for 2 months. At the end of October, he and Anne flew to Paris for a conference of Nobel laureates. It was, he said, full of persons so distinguished that I felt a proper tramp. The then mayor of Paris, Jacques Chirac, presented all the laureates with parchment scrolls and medals, except Golding, as his had somehow been mislaid. He thought afterwards he should have quipped, "Je pense, mais je n'existe pas." But in fact, he admits, he just grinned sheepishly and murmured that it didn't matter. Meanwhile, there were seemingly endless foreign press and television interviews. He was filmed riding cobber for Portuguese TV and spoke for 25 minutes in French for Swiss TV, a breakthrough, he felt, in his contest with the French language. In November, he went to London for a reception at the Swedish embassy, where he was introduced to the Duke of Edinburgh. The Duke observed that it was a pity there wasn't a Nobel Prize for Engineering. Golding replied that it would be a mistake to spread the prize money too widely, which caused, he records, paroxysms of royal mirth. Long before their departure for the award ceremony in Stockholm, he was feeling sick of all this Nobel stuff. On the 20th of November, he was brought briefly into contact with something that really mattered, when his daughter Judy gave birth to her third child, Roger. Driving down to Bristol with Anne, he found that the new arrival was a fine little baby. Judy looked positively blooming, and Nicky and Laurie were delighted with their brother. A less momentous, though still gratifying event in November was his debut, and, as it turned out, also his swan song, as an exhibiting artist. An American dealer called Wilma Wayne, with a gallery in Old Bond Street, had written to the Goldings to say she was putting on an exhibition of art done by prominent people, and would they like to submit something? He and Anne both sent two paintings. One of his was a tiny, beautifully precise watercolour of Anne, seated at her easel before a background of trees, which he'd painted on one of their French holidays. His other painting, called Christmas Celebrations, showed three dustbins full of empty bottles. On Monday, the 5th of December, they flew to Stockholm for the sumptuous and protracted Nobel celebrations. Each laureate had a personal minder, allocated by the Swedish Ministry for Foreign Affairs, and Golding's was called Karin. "A charming girl," he said. On the Wednesday, he gave his Nobel lecture. Writing it had been a chore. It had seemed to him to limp from the trite to the turgid. However, it went as well as could be expected, he thought, given that the audience were following it word for word in translations and made a deafening noise when they turned their pages. On Thursday, it was snowing. They had a splendid lunch with his Swedish publisher, slept in the afternoon, and had drinks at the British Residency. On Friday, they met all the same people again at a residency lunch and a reception at the Swedish Academy. Then they had an hour in bed and went to a concert. The Nutcracker Suite was, he found, fun and soothing. I went to sleep in the middle. Saturday was the big day. There was a rehearsal of the prize presentation ceremony in the grand auditorium of the concert hall at 11 o'clock, and the ceremony itself began at 4:30, with the entrance of the Swedish royal family, followed by the procession of Nobel laureates. The podium was decorated with begonias and roses from San Remo, where Alfred Nobel died in 1896. Swedish flags were draped above it, and behind it was the Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra and the Swedish soloist Sylvia Lindensland. There were musical interludes after the presentation of each prize. In previous years, the music chosen had related in some way to the laureates, but as 1983 was the 150th anniversary of Nobel's birth, the music played was from the countries he had lived in. After King Gustav had handed Golding his gold medal and diploma, the orchestra played the Farandole from Bizet's L'Alésienne Suite No. 2. The Nobel ceremony was very boring, I'm afraid, though the music made up for the impenetrable Swedish, was Golding's verdict. The banquet afterwards was ghastly. They assembled at 7 to be introduced to the Swedish royal family, the Prime Minister, and members of the government. On meeting the author of Lord of the Flies, King Gustav remarked that he'd had to read the book at school. Not the most enthusiastic endorsement. Then they all processed to the Blue Hall, each laureate taking the royal who would be next to him at table. Golding accompanied Princess Christina for, his journal estimates, about a quarter of a mile through halls and staircases, and couldn't find anything to say to her. The meal went on forever. His dress shirt studs didn't work, and over coffee, each laureate had to make a 3-minute speech from a special pulpit. Golding was bored and furious. Then a procession of university students entered the hall with banners and a choir to pay tribute to the laureates, after which the King and Queen led the way to the Golden Hall, where there were more refreshments, and the laureates were taken off to give interviews for Swedish television. Then there was a ball. The Goldings left earlier than anyone else, and his opinion, confided to his journal, was that he had earned a considerable slice of that 120,000 in the course of the evening. Things got better after that. In Sweden, on Santa Lucia's Day, the shortest day of the year, girls dress up in white with crowns of candles, and there are beauty contests in which the year Santa Lucia is chosen. Golding had been selected to crown the 1983 winner, Yvonne Reading, who a year later was to become Miss Universe. It was dark and snowing steadily, and Karin, his minder, took him to a hut in the woods. Soon a procession appeared, led by the saint, wearing, as he recalls, a crown of electric candles and a very low-cut dress, with little girls singing and bearing candles behind her. Golding's task was to emerge from the hut and put a necklace round her neck while she smiled a smile so wide that it eclipsed her earrings. He had to do it 3 times before the publicity people were satisfied. When he finally got back to the hut with the saint, he found that she was a charming girl who confessed that her feet and her candles were killing her. The Nobel was by no means the end of Golding's career. In the following years, he published the second and third parts of his Sea Trilogy, both bestsellers, and a wonderfully sardonic travel book, An Egyptian Journal. He died quite suddenly, aged 82, one summer night in 1993, after throwing a big party for family and friends. The Nobel triumph was not his happiest time either. He disliked pomp and circumstance and hated appearing in public. He looked for happiness in his imagination, not in the real world. In all the 5,000 pages of his journal, which he kept for 22 years, it is hard to find a day when he was completely happy. The nearest, perhaps, came in September 1972, when he and Anne were on holiday in Rome and visiting Hadrian's villa. He likes it, he writes, because absolutely no culture is necessary, and the wild flowers and butterflies are a delightful riot. It is their 33rd wedding anniversary, and he feels that Anne has stuck it extremely well, seeing how much she's had to put up with. So he decides to record, in an un-British way, how much I love her, and how much she has done for me, from bed to books. For I would never have been as happy in the one with someone else, nor have written the others with someone else, or indeed written anything.
Christian Rodsker has been reading the final part of William Golding, the man who wrote Lord of the Flies, written and abridged by John Carey. It was directed by Bruce Young. And don't forget that you can hear the next episode of Lord of the Flies in Saturday's Seventh Dimension at 6:30 and 12:30.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. This is Joanna Pinnock, where it's time for Drama Now. And in a moment, we come to the final part of Arnold Bennett's Anna of the Five Towns. Then to Mel, who today will be geocaching, armed with plenty of Kendall mint cake, making friends with some extremely chatty parrots, and tuning into the final part of this week's classic story, Swallows and Amazons by Arthur Ransom. That's all from 4 o'clock. So now to our drama, and it's the second and final part of Anna of the Five Towns, Arnold Bennett's story of love and rebellion set in the Staffordshire Potteries in the 19th century. Having inherited a fortune on her 21st birthday, Anna Tellwright begins to gain independence and freedom, but on her return from an eventful holiday with the Suttons, her joy is marred by some shocking news.
Anna, nurse says it's time for Millie's bath. She thought you would want to do it.
Will you do it, Agnes? She'd like that.
Of course I will. Are you still feeling sad?
I'm all right. I'm just thinking. Remembering.
Oh, Anna. Perhaps the body isn't Willie Price. Perhaps it's someone else. Just someone who had a terrible accident.
I don't think Mr. Sutton would be wrong about something like that.
But
don't worry, dear. I'll come and kiss Millie goodnight soon. I just need some time.
All right then, sis.
Right, these fishing lines are ready. Will you have a go first, Anna?
Yes, I'll certainly try.
The last 2 weeks of that summer, I was away on the Isle of Man. I wish I could say that I thought of you every day, William, but the truth is, I hardly thought of you at all.